Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett. Tonight on PBS News Weekend, investigating January 6th, we get the latest on where the House Committee's investigation is heading with Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren. Then we dig into the hotly contested Senate and gubernatorial races in Florida just 6 weeks from Election Day. And soccer player Olivia Moultrie, who started her professional career at the age of 13, on making and setting goals both on and off the field.
My love has contributed to a lot of hard work and me just wanting to go after it every single day. And I think, you know, that's mostly what I can attribute any success I've had to, that and just wanting it and going for it and setting those goals and being willing to, you know, go after them every day.
All that and the day's headlines on tonight's PBS News Weekend. Good evening. It's great to be with you. And at this hour, Tropical Storm Ian is rapidly strengthening in the Caribbean and bearing down on Cuba. The storm is forecast to reach hurricane strength as early as overnight and could make landfall along the Gulf Coast of Florida by Thursday or Friday. President Biden preemptively declared an emergency for the state, making federal government assistance available as the storm draws closer. Meantime, in Canada, residents are reeling in the wake of Hurricane Fiona. The storm washed homes into the sea, and hurricane-strength winds tore apart homes and toppled trees. Hundreds of thousands of Canadians remain without power, and the Canadian military has been mobilized to assist in the recovery. Officials there say it will take months to rebuild. In Italy, polls are closing at this hour as the country chooses a new government that could be both historic and could pivot the nation toward far-right leadership. Opinion polls suggest that Italy could pick its first ever female prime minister, Giorgia Meloni. She is the leader of the far-right Brothers of Italy party, which has its roots in Italy's 20th century neo-fascist movement that emerged after the death of fascist leader Mussolini back in 1945. And violent unrest continues in Iran following the death of a 22-year-old woman in police custody for wearing her hijab improperly. Iranian state TV has reported at least 41 protesters and police have now been killed since violent clashes began earlier this month. It's been the largest anti-government demonstration seen in years. Demonstrations in solidarity have occurred elsewhere in the Middle East, Europe, and even here in the U.S. And Kenyan Eliud Kipchoge shattered his own world record in the Berlin Marathon earlier today. The 37-year-old runner finished in 2 hours, 1 minute, and 9 seconds. That's 30 seconds better than his previous world record set in 2018. Kipchoge is also the first person to ever run a marathon in under 2 hours, but his time was not recognized because it was on a controlled course. And still to come on PBS News Weekend, a closer look at Florida politics and the upcoming midterms, and a conversation with rising soccer star Olivia Moultrie of the Portland Thorns.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
The House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol will hold at least one more public hearing this week before concluding its work. Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren is a member of that committee and joins us now to talk more about that and her House-passed bipartisan bill that aims to overhaul the process for certifying presidential elections. Congresswoman Lofgren, thanks so much for being with us.
You bet.
So the January 6th committee, as we mentioned, it's holding another public hearing this Wednesday, the first in more than 2 months. How much new information are we going to see, and what will the focus of Wednesday's hearing be?
Well, we have found some new information. We've been working throughout the summer, and although the public hearings are important in terms of informing the public, they're far from all of what we've been doing, honestly, gathering information and also considering recommendations that we might make to have the country be safer.
I want to ask you about something Congresswoman Liz Cheney, your colleague, said publicly yesterday. She said that the January 6th committee has obtained some 800,000 U.S. Secret Service communications from on or around January 6th. She says that some of the texts are gone, but there are some other forms of communication now in the committee's possession. What more can you tell us about that, and what do you see as the significance of those documents?
Well, I think it gives us some insight into what the Secret Service knew, what they communicated to other law enforcement agencies, most particularly the Capitol Police, who are charged with securing the safety of the Capitol, certainly what the president's intentions were on the 6th. There's a whole variety, you know, Liz is right, some of the text messages, as we know, were erased, even though the service had been ordered to preserve them. But there's other forms of information. There's radio traffic, there's emails, there's Teams messages, and on and on. It's a huge volume of material, and frankly, it's a major task to go through and sort through what's relevant and what is irrelevant. So our staff is working hard at that.
Earlier this month, Congressman Jamie Raskin said the committee assumes that former Vice President Mike Pence will testify before the panel. Is that still a working assumption? Has your committee received any commitments from him or his team?
Well, he said publicly that he would be very interested in coming in, and then that was walked back. The fact is that were we to engage in compulsion, there are issues about that. There isn't time for the litigation to run its course between now and the end of this Congress. So, you know, we had thought he would come in because he said he would, but I think he had a change of heart.
A question about the timeline. You've got this hearing on Wednesday, potentially one more hearing to outline the committee's findings, its work product. Do you expect that you'll be able to present your report before the midterms?
Oh, I doubt that. It's, you know, it's a huge volume of material, and we are working hard to get the report concluded. As you know, select committees are established for the life of one Congress. We've always known that, and this Congress is ending at the end of December. So we have to get it done before then, but we want it to be complete, accessible. We may have a few other pieces of information that we can provide to the public, but I doubt very much that the full report will be done by the end of October.
As we wrap up our conversation, the House this past week passed a set of electoral reforms that you introduced along with Congresswoman Liz Cheney, aimed at shoring up ambiguities in the presidential certification process, which Donald Trump and his allies tried to exploit in overturning Joe Biden's win. That picked up some support from 9 House Republicans, all of whom are retiring from Congress. What are the next steps? There's a similar effort in the Senate. That bill differs from the one that the House passed. What happens next?
Well, the Senate is proceeding, and obviously there are conversations underway between myself and Liz and senators. They have a markup scheduled, I think, for Tuesday on their bill. There's a lot of overlap, just as there are some dissimilarities. As they make amendments, we'll see if there are elements that we covered that they didn't, that they might be interested in. Doesn't mean they'll do it exactly the way we did. But I'm hopeful that we will use the legislative process to come to an agreement. There's no reason why we can't have a meeting of the minds using the legislative process. So I fully expect that we will. It will not be done next week because both the House and Senate will be in recess until after the election. But I believe we will come to a meeting of the minds.
Any concerns that reconciling the two pieces of legislation or finding some compromise would make it less effective?
Well, obviously, we thought our bill was the best, and probably the Senate thinks theirs is the best. But the deal is that, you know, you don't have to get 100% of your way in order to have an improvement to existing law. And so that's what my goal is. I'm sure that's what the senator's goal is. There shouldn't be, and I don't believe there will be, intransigence. We want to make a better law that keeps our country safer than it is now. And there's no doubt that we can get to that point if we work in good faith. And I intend to, and I'm sure the senators do as well.
Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, Democrat from California and a member of the January 6th committee. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
Time now for our weekend briefing. With the midterms now 44 days away, we're taking a closer look at some of the most competitive races around the country. And this evening, we're zeroing in on Florida. For that, I'm joined by two top political strategists. Steve Shale ran Barack Obama's 2008 political campaign in Florida and has served as an advisor for lots of statewide races. And Al Cardenas is the former chair of the Florida Republican Party and served as an advisor for Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Due to some technical issues, Mr. Cardenas is joining us by phone. It's great to have the both of you with us.
Thanks for having us.
It's my pleasure.
All right, so let's get down to it. And let's start with the Senate race between incumbent Republican Senator Marco Rubio and Congresswoman Val Demings, former Orlando police chief. She is polling, and I just checked this, she's polling about 3 points behind Rubio, according to the Real Clear Politics polling average. But she has outraised Rubio this cycle. She's spending more on TV ads. But the thing is, Steve, that Republicans now enjoy an advantage of more than 200,000 active registered voters than Democrats. So, Steve, given that, can Val Demings make any real headway in this race?
I think she's got a tough climb. I think she's done a great job getting out early and defining herself. I think, you know, again, obviously raised good money. I think the biggest challenge she has, frankly, is, you know, it's hard to get to a win in Florida as a Democrat if you're, you know, if you're basically even in Miami-Dade County. And, you know, you have the combination of Republicans are doing better with Hispanics, which I think is as much about Democrats not doing well with Hispanics. And you've got the fact that Rubio has a hometown advantage there. I think she's going to keep it close. I certainly wouldn't say she has no chance, but I think it's a pretty uphill climb, unfortunately.
Let's talk about the Supreme Court Dobbs decision, because that really shifted the landscape across the country and certainly in Florida. And last month, Senator Rubio said in an interview that he believed that abortion should be decided at the state level, but now he's co-sponsoring a bill with Senator Lindsey Graham that would impose a federal ban on abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Al, what impact might Rubio's stance on that issue have in this race?
Well, most of the polls show that the Supreme Court decision favors Democrats, and I think it's a 62-63% disapproval rate in America on the Dobbs decision. So the question is, how much will impact turnout at the polls? I think the Demings-Rubio race might be a close one for three reasons. One, most statewide races over the last 20 or 30 years have been decided by 2 points or less in Florida for the Senate and for the governorship. And so this is one of those races. You know, being within 3 or 4 points on election day means you've got a shot, because nobody has measured turnout rates until the end of election day. And so, you know, early voting, absentee voting will give us a hint as to where turnout is. And also, she has money, which many many Senate Democrat candidates do not around the country. So I would say this is a race to watch. It certainly leans Republican, but it's not out of the question that Val Demings will have a chance if, and that's a big if, Democrats win the turnout battle, enthused perhaps by the Supreme Court abortion decision.
Let's talk about the governor's race there in Florida, because Republicans in recent years, they've made inroads with some Latino voters, Hispanic voters. But after sending about 50 migrants from Texas to Martha's Vineyard, Governor Ron DeSantis is now facing not only backlash from some Venezuelan voters in Florida, but he's also got a class action lawsuit and other legal scrutiny as well. Al, you know, DeSantis has been maintaining a lead. He has a fairly high favorable approval rating in Florida. But can this issue give his Democratic opponent, Charlie Crist, Could that give him an opening here?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. And the reason why I don't know the answer to that is the press has been predictably very tough on Governor DeSantis regarding that issue for a whole host of reasons, not just the immigration. And whether that has more legs to run for the next few weeks or not, we'll have to see how that goes. But right now, I mean, look, Governor DeSantis won by 35,000 votes last time, which is far less than 1%. Mm-hmm. As I said earlier, you know, these elections in Florida are decided by a narrower percentage of votes, although Republicans in the last two or three years have made a huge gain in voter registration. The DeSantis race looks like there's a wider gap than in the Senate race in his favor because Charlie Crist doesn't count with the resources that Democrats have given Val Demings on the Senate race. And so Charlie Crist has had to go dark for a few weeks on TV, and that's hard to hurt him. DeSantis ads on TV are pretty effective. I would say this race I would put on the Republican column unless something happens, but don't be surprised if on election day it's a 2 or 3 point victory.
Steve, on that point, I mean, why aren't Democrats marshaling more money and more resources into Florida to give Crist more of a fighting chance?
Yeah, I think the biggest problem is you have a lot of donors who feel like they put a lot of money into Florida the last few cycles and it hasn't worked out. And I think DeSantis, you know, getting out there and raising so much money early has given him a huge advantage. I mean, I agree with Al completely. There's no reason why Florida couldn't be and shouldn't be competitive. The voter registration thing is as much about Republicans having lost fewer voters than Democrats. The biggest gain are among independents. And so I think that there is definitely an opportunity here. The biggest challenge is, you know, I think Democrats around the country are triaging money in other states where we need to kind of win Senate races. That moves this race down the totem pole. But I do think if you saw a few polls come in that saw Crist pretty close, I think some money would come in late. I certainly agree with Al that, you know, there's no reason to write either one of these state races off now. I just think it's uphill climb for my party in both of them at the moment.
Al Cardenas and Steve Shale, thanks so much for your time. Time now for our weekend spotlight. In 2019, 13-year-old soccer phenom Olivia Moultrie turned pro and inked a 9-year endorsement deal with Nike. But she's had to fight her way onto the field. It's been over a year since she signed with the Portland Thorns after suing to join the National Women's Soccer League, which requires players to at least be 18 years old to compete. The men's league has no such age requirement. This year, Moultrie also became the youngest player in the league's history to score a goal at age 16. Olivia Moultrie joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, of course. I'm really excited.
And as I understand it, when you were all of 7 years old, you sat down and you wrote out exactly what you wanted to do with your life. You created a goal and then created a plan to achieve that goal. How's it going? Are you sticking to your plan?
Yeah, I mean, the plan, it wasn't, when I was seven, it was easy. It was a little like step-by-step plan. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and then, you know, I'm going to reach my goals, and it's going to be a nice, perfect little segue into everything. And that's definitely not what it has been, but, you know, the goal has remained the same, and maybe the process has changed a little bit, but we're getting closer every single day. And so, yeah, it's cool to think that that goal has stayed the same even from when I was seven.
Lots of kids start playing soccer at the age of 6 or 7. Very few, in fact, no other female athletes have done what you've done. What makes you different?
Honestly, I think that just my love for the game, and in terms of just what I've done on and off the field, I think it's just my love has contributed to a lot of hard work and me just wanting to go after it every single day. And when I created that goal, it was like, okay, now I just had such a, you know, strong will to want to accomplish it that it just went into how I worked for it every single day. And I think, you know, that's mostly what I can attribute any success I've had to, that and just wanting it and going for it and setting those goals and being willing to, you know, go after them every day.
You became a professional soccer player at the age of 13. That was after committing to the University of North Carolina at the age of 11. And then backing out so that you could go pro. But your family had to file a lawsuit in order for you to play with the National Women's Soccer League. Why was that lawsuit necessary?
Basically, you know, the gist of it was just the rules in place. I wasn't 18 yet. And, you know, I felt that I was ready. Portland felt that I was ready. And, you know, they backed us the whole time, which, of course, I am truly grateful for that. And it was just a matter of, you know, equality in terms of opportunity for men and women. You know, the men didn't have the role and the women did. And I felt like that was wrong. And I would have wanted anyone in my position, you know, to fight for that. So I'm happy that I was able to. And I'm happy that we don't have that problem anymore.
Your teammates, who I imagine were 10, 15 years older, how did they respond to you? Were they receptive?
They were extremely supportive of me. At one point in court, a bunch of my teammates showed up for me, you know, to support me through that time and continued asking me while I was going through the process how it was going, what it was going to look like, was I going to be able to play, when it was going to happen. So, yeah, they were extremely supportive of me, and I'm extremely grateful for that relationship and just really feeling like a big part of the team during that time. And then obviously officially being able to be a team member was a really exciting moment for me. So, yeah, it was great.
You have two younger sisters, is that right?
Yes.
I would imagine that your soccer career is pretty much, you know, all-consuming for your family. What's your family life like? How do your parents manage all of this?
They are definitely busy. It definitely helped when I got my driver's license a couple months ago. That, you know, took a big load off of them. But my entire family has been extremely supportive and flexible. And every time, you know, since moving to Portland, they all came with me. And my sisters have, you know, been a huge part of just supporting me and being at everything. You know, every club game and tournament I can remember, they were there. So were my parents, willing to drive me to everything. And, you know, they've had to give up some things for that. And, you know, I'm eternally grateful for their support and willingness to get me where I needed to go. And now, you know, they get to be a little bit more hands off now that I'm a professional. And it's kind of just that's my life and my job now. But yeah, they were busy. And now they get a little bit of more time to take care of my other two sisters. But they've been extremely supportive. And I'm really grateful for that.
You are, as we mentioned, the youngest player to ever play and score in a National Women's Soccer League game. What was that moment like when you scored your first goal?
I mean, honestly, I was really excited inside, even if it didn't really look like that. I've rewatched it a couple times, and everyone's like, you didn't even celebrate. You just kind of jogged off. And, you know, for me, I hope that's one of many. And that was kind of, you know, just a process and a moment within the process that I'm like, okay, great. I'm extremely excited that it happened. And now it's kind of on to the next, you know, because this is just the beginning, I hope, for me. And I want to accomplish a lot. And so, of course, I was excited when it happened and also just felt an urgency, you know, a want for more.
Who are some of your favorite players? Who are the people that you look up to on the field?
It's hard for me to, you know, pick a favorite because it's like, well, I get to play with them now. You know, I get to learn from them face to face right there, you know, 6 yards away. And it's just super cool, and it's helped me grow a lot. Obviously, now we're competing for a championship, and I'm a part of that, and that's extremely exciting and just, you know, another part of the journey.
Yeah. I have to ask, though, at 16, I mean, do you ever feel like you're missing out on foundational experiences that other people your age get to have?
To be completely honest, what I'm doing is my dream, you know? I've wanted to be a professional player since I was 7 years old, so to me, it's like, I'm not missing out on anything. I'm just getting the opportunities that I've always wanted, and I'm living the life that I've always wanted to have. Like, soccer is what I love the most, you know, other than my family. If we're talking, you know, a job and a career, what I want to do.
Priorities.
This is what it is. Yeah, exactly. And this is that. And so I really wouldn't trade that for anything. And I love being able to chase after my goals every day and do it in this environment.
What's your ultimate goal, Olivia?
Ultimately, I want to be the best player in the world, and obviously that's a big thing to say, and that can encompass a lot of things, I think, but for me, it's just really fun to feel like I have these people supporting me, and I get to chase after that every day, and, you know, hopefully, ultimately accomplish that.
Yeah, you are well on your way. Olivia Moultrie, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And online right now, learn what goes into a political poll from statisticians and pollsters and how it can help in navigating this election season. All that and more is on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is our program for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett. For all of us here at PBS News Weekend, Thanks for spending part of your Sunday with us. Have a great week.